This is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time for a new episode of Kings of the Podcast. Buckle up. Here we go.
Here we go, Kings fans. Kings of the Podcast, episode 178. Dennis, the mood in Los Angeles took a dark turn over the last 24 hours. I think, at least from my perspective, there was some optimism heading into the midseason press conference yesterday, even though the team has not been playing well. But the air came out of the balloon at Crypto. That's a very long intro, Dennis. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jay. I'm doing better than probably 95% of the fans at this point in time, but I'm doing great, and we will have a very, I think, honest and pointed discussion about what's going on with the team right now.
Yeah, for sure. There is a lot to unpack that has gone on over the last 24 hours. Normally, we like to do a recap of what's happened on the ice since our last episode, but really, I think that we can fast forward, and the majority of the news or items to cover would be stuff that's happened in the last 24 hours. Todd McClellan, I wouldn't call it a press conference. It was just really his normal everyday post morning skate a meeting with the media. So we had that yesterday. Then the midseason report card. It's the in vogue thing to do around the NHL now, which is to hold a midseason press conference with the general manager. Normally, you wouldn't have a meeting with the GM until the trade deadline. That's still about 6 weeks away, early March. So we have that. And then, of course, the loss, the 2-1 defeat at the hands of the Nashville Predators. So we can get into that, Dennis. I don't even really know where to start because there's so much. But I would like to start here with two things. One is an open message to the fans. I know sometimes people think that we're being a little bit too critical, the Twitter donkeys, et cetera, about the fans. So let's be very clear, Dennis. You and I love the fans. We interact with them. Whether it's online, whether it's at the elevators in between periods, we love the fans. We don't love all the takes, but we love the fans. We don't profess to be any smarter than they are, or, you know, we disagree with people at times. But I think what you and I, correct me if I'm wrong, I'll let you speak for yourself. I think what we try to do is be a vessel of communication. So information comes our way from sources or from players or from management or from even our own observations of being in the room and around the team, right? We have access that the average fan doesn't have. So we try to communicate and share. And some people want to reject that and then act as if it's not true. And so we're trying to share information. And sometimes I think it's also important for people to delineate and differentiate between sometimes we're giving you our opinion and sometimes we're giving you actual real information. I use Matt Roy as an example. I wrote a piece within the last 24 hours prior to the press conference and everything that the Kings were going to take a wait and see approach with Matt Roy. That was not an opinion piece. That was me sharing. I wish people could see your face. I always say that. Yeah. At least once an episode, people could see your face. That was me sharing information. And sometimes people like to attack back as if I'm the general manager or I'm in charge of the team or I'm the coach and I'm making those decisions. If you would like to know my opinion about what I would do with Matt Roy, I will tell you. But what the article was about was not about my opinion. Anyway, Dennis, would you second many of those comments? You love the fans as well, or they're all just donkeys to you?
Well, to your point about Roy, Blake affirmed that in the press conference.
Yeah, he did.
So you wrote the story. Blake, so like, what do fans want, right? Like, here's the thing. I 100% agree. Like, you know, we're the most visible two members of the media, right? Mm-hmm. We don't sit in the press box during period breaks in LA. We go downstairs. So anybody that wants to talk to us, and the ones that come up are amazing and loyal fans and great and supportive of our work. Like, we don't hide. Like, it's simple as that. Now, with respect to what's going on now, look, here's the thing. I'll say this and about the takes, right? Right now, I have more respect for somebody that when I do my post-game tweet about, you know, big picture, little picture, medium picture, more respect for a coach that someone just responds, fire the coach, as opposed to the fans who now think they know what's going on behind the scenes in the room. There's accountability. Please, you don't know any of that stuff. You're sitting on your couch or your seat in the arena, and you think you know what's going on in the room, and you haven't talked to anybody about it. So you can make all these assumptions about what's going on internally with this team. That's great. You can have your opinion about it. I have no problem. Look, we have a great relationship with Todd. We've had for 4 years. He's been very open and communicative with us. Like, losing at this extent won't save anyone, right? So no problem with Rob going to, you know, yesterday to the media and saying that. They're not looking at a change right now, right? But some of these takes about, like, you think you know what's going on behind the scenes. Like, I talk to these players. They haven't quit on the coach. And I watched their efforts. What's it? They've now lost 7 one-goal games in, I think, their last 11 games. Like, they're not that bad of a team. They can't be this bad of a team. But, like I said, losing doesn't save anyone. So it could change. It could change rapidly. But I have no problem with the responses, and we're not hiding. And the other thing is that, John, you know, like, I'm independent. Like, you have an affiliation with the team. And then there's this take that we're mouthpieces for the team. Like, please. Like, if you've read my, like, over the last 20 years, you really think I've been totally supportive of this organization? Absolutely not. So these perceptions that come out, that the other one was, we don't ask hard questions.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah. Was that a hard question yesterday that I asked to Rob about the coach? Like, so just stop that. And I get the frustration. I think a lot of this is born out of frustration. But again, like, the personal stuff, and you're not doing this and that, doing your job, like, forget it. Like, and now people want me to call for the coach. Like, it's going to, like, he's either going to win some games and they're going to move on this own stand. And I'll put it out there right now, John. You got to beat San Jose and Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Like, so whatever Rob said yesterday, if you don't win those games, then what do you do? Like, then there'll be a change. So, I mean, that's my take on the whole situation. I'm probably angered the 6 donkeys that don't like me anyway on social media. But you know what? It comes with the territory, so it's fine.
No, it does come with the territory. And I don't want to make this all about responses on social media. We have a lot to unpack. I just want to touch on 2 things that you said, though. One is that you and I spoke post-game last night, and I think that we're in agreement. Again, these are more opinions now. Let's try to help separate that. We're in agreement that this little stretch of 6 or 7 games here left before the All-Star break is pretty critical, because then the team is essentially shut down for 2 weeks, and that would be time to pause and reflect and really figure out if you're in management. We're assuming that would be a time. So this next little stretch is very important, ultra important. And the second thing I just wanted to touch on would be the thing about hard questions. What's interesting to me, or maybe what I find frustrating at times, is those aren't my questions. So those might be a question, or some of those questions that other people have. Well, why don't you use Byfield in overtime? That's a real popular one right now.
Yeah, that is a popular one.
I don't know. That's just not a question that I have right now, Dennis. When I sort of rank you go into a press conference, and you're only going to get to ask about 3 questions, because there's a room full of media, right? You don't go, I mean, you and I have never talked about what your pre-press conference strategy is, but you don't have a list, or if you do, of 10 questions, you're not going to be able to get to all 10 of them. You have to let the room breathe and other people, your peers, ask questions as well. Why Byfield isn't being used in overtime? I'm sorry, Dennis. It's not one of my top 5 questions. I have other questions that to me are more important or more interesting, or that I can be able to write an article about or have discussion about on the podcast. So I'm just trying to give people a peek behind the curtain when I say that. It's a valid question. I don't deny their question. But when to attack you or to attack me or anybody else in the media and say, you're not asking tough questions, you're not asking the right questions, that's a little annoying and frustrating, because I feel, at least, Dennis, that we ask the questions that need to be asked, and we share that information, whether it's on social media or on the podcast or on radio interviews or in written articles or whatever. So anyway, moving on. Speaking of written articles, Dennis, I wanted to get your take on this.
Sure.
A lot has been written recently about oh, Todd McClellan, he's, you know, he's the new Terry Murray. He put structure in place, but he can't get the team over the hump, and then they need their Daryl Sutter. Here's what I would say about that, Dennis. I don't really like comparables. I don't like comparables when it comes to players. Like, oh, who does Alex Turcotte remind you of? It's very difficult. Alex Turcotte is Alex Turcotte, and Akeel Thomas is Akeel Thomas. I don't know. I don't want to hear he's the next Kyle Clifford. He's the, who's our Mike Richards? That's like a question that comes up too. To me, Terry Murray is a completely different person. He was a different coach at a different place and time with a different team, a largely young team. So like when you really start breaking it down, Todd McClellan is not Terry Murray. And the team that Todd McClellan has is not the same team that Terry Murray had. Right? Like, do you see where I'm going with this? Like the comparables, it's just like whenever the Kings make a trade for somebody with Columbus or whenever they're having a difficult stretch, social media pops up with, you know, oh, they just need to make a trade with Columbus. That'll solve everything, you know, because of Jeff Carter. It's like, oh, no, it doesn't work that way. It's not a comparable. Todd McClellan is a different situation than the Terry Murray situation. I just think that's too easy to go to is what I'm trying to get at, Dennis. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, if people want to romanticize about what happened 12 years ago, they can. I will tell you this. The Kings have made a coaching change in season after Daryl Sutter came in. You know what it was? it was John Stevens, and you put in Willie DeJardin. Right?
It's a different situation, though, too.
So that's all different. So, and I'll submit to you, there's three teams this season that made coaching changes. Like Edmonton, Ottawa, and Minnesota. Edmonton, the coach was gifted. Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl at their bottom. And the team has done incredibly well, been better defense. But the other two teams, Ottawa's 29th and Minnesota's 27th. So if you choose to make that move, you're probably pulling the ripcord on the season, right? Because that Daryl Sutter thing that happened, like – coming over the hill and making this team, you can romp Miss Sansa. It's not reality. It's not what's going on today. Now,
lightning in a bottle.
What's hurting Todd is obviously his history in Edmonton, where he couldn't get the team over the hump, and certainly in San Jose, which resonates a lot more with Kings fans because he was up 3-0 and the team beat him, you know, in 2014. So that's it. And I've said this, John. Like I've been the one thing I've been consistent about, and people can point fingers, whatever. This season's going to be judged by the 82 games. Not by 42 games. Now, with the mitigating circumstance to where if they lose the next 5 out of 6, all bets are off. But this team was built to win. I'm going to assess it on 82 games. I wrote an article. It's coming out today about grades, and people probably go upside down because, John, when you look at this team, here's the thing that really makes it difficult to judge these players and the team halfway through the season. Like, give me the player, and we all can name one, that's underachieved for this team. There's one that's classically underachieved, and it's hurt the team. You could probably make a case for Kaliev, but other than that, nobody's underachieved. If anything, somebody like Trevor Moore has overachieved. Byfield has come to his own. So it's really difficult to look at this
Cam
team
Talbot.
And say, okay, Cam Talbot, exactly.
He could go down the list.
Yes, but, you know, look, the team hasn't gotten great goaltending lately. They're not that good defensive. You know, I looked it up, John. 8 of the last 11 games, they've given up 3 goals or more. So there's something going on defensively. Maybe teams tuned into their 1-3-1 scheme or whatever, just not executing as well. And, John, I'll go to the last point. I think that – and this is what probably hurts the coach the most. You can't be 7-8-5 at home and think you're a Stanley Cup contender. You can't do it. Like, that's the one thing that when I look at that, and you look at all the other teams in this league that are legit contenders – fine. So that's kind of my, you know, take on the situation. And I think it just will resolve itself. And then, like you said, it will resolve itself by the All-Star game.
If more of this concerns, then
you know what's going to happen. If it doesn't and they turn back, fine. Then you try to, you know, grab a playoff spot.
I think that goaltending is something that has not been discussed enough during all of this. And if you really break down Rob's comments from yesterday, Rob Blake, during his midseason press conference, he talked about structure, obviously. He also talked about offense and he talked about defense. The offensive numbers, it's all about chances. They've been generating the chances, but they have not been finishing on those chances.
No.
And that's why the goal scoring has come down. So whether that's confidence or guys gripping the sticks too tight or just puck luck or whatever it is, You know, it happens to every player throughout the season. It, you know, is it just a weird anomaly where it's happening to a bunch of players all at once? Maybe, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, are the line combinations that were working so well earlier in the year, maybe they're not finding what they need? But the goaltending, Dennis, has not really been discussed enough. Cam Talbot has really cooled off. Yeah. And that is an issue, because if the team is not generating offense, you need your goaltender to be better. And if you, I mean, just look at last night. I mean, you mm-hmm. can't fault, and he's the number three goalie on the depth chart, right? But he might be, right. he might become the new number one goaltender in the short term.
Well, he's got to play more. Like, and right now, Cam's on track for 58 starts. That's too much.
Well, and yeah. Todd addressed it after the game last night as well. Yeah. Riddick is, he's going to get more starts. I mean, whether that's the, you know, two of the next three games, or whether it's just the immediate next start against New York, whatever it is, he's going to be getting more starts. I think the Kings mm-hmm. are at least now at this moment in kind of a 1A, 1B, where earlier yep. they were in a Talbot 70-30 rotation. I think yep. it's at least 50-50. And mm-hmm. my point is, if you look at last night's game, they were in that game. The goaltender gave them the game that he needed to give them.
Yeah.
Didn't give up a lot. The offense mm-hmm. needed to generate more. They can't keep just scoring one goal per game and expect to have any sort of success. I'm curious to see where your grades you know, are. And I don't even, can't even believe I'm about to say this, because I'll probably be lit up on social media. You said about the classic overachievement of Dubois. Yes, we've covered it so many times on the program. Yes, mm-hmm. he could be giving more. I'm sorry, though. I still give this guy a little bit of the benefit of the doubt when I look at the fact that he's playing on the third line and I look at mm-hmm. who he's playing with. And yeah. that's... to me, that just has to be factored into the situation.
Well, it does, but did you pay, if you knew he was going to be the third line center, would you pay him $8.5 million?
That's again, the thing. Here's the issue, though. Okay. You signed that player for the future. You signed that player for the playoffs. He doesn't need to earn his check in January, as much as people don't want to hear that. He needs to earn his check in game 83.
He does, but when the rest of the team, like on this road trip, they really could have used him to stand up.
They could have.
And he didn't. And that's my few good moments. Yeah, but no, he didn't score five goals in six games. He didn't.
Well,
he wasn't the lead dog, right? He wasn't the lead dog. And when I read my analysis, they're getting a $3.5 million value for an $8.5 million check. That's what they're getting right now.
That's fair.
And that's the reality of it. Now, if you want to write the story on the trade right now, 42 games in, you know how you're going to write the story. Like, the Winnipeg Jets are the best team in the NHL. And the Kings have lost, 10 of 11. So there's just, you want to write it now? Fine. And I agree with you. But in the moment when they needed him, it wasn't his time, right? Now, so how about other times.
So how about this then? Why not move him off the third line? Like, you know, I mean, I've been opposed to that. I've the one that said, just leave him at the 3C, keep 55 up there. That top line carried the team earlier in the year. The top line mm-hmm. has not been performing of late. Why not? And then Todd seemed opposed to it, even at the morning press conference. And then 6 hours later,
yeah,
he flipped them last night in the game. I mean, I don't know where that's going, if it's going to, you know, continue, but he did take a look at it. It was situational, though, because
yeah,
I don't want to say his hand was forced. It sounds so dramatic, but when QB went down last night, it created an opportunity, an unexpected opportunity. But if you're that worried about 80, and when I say you, I don't mean you, I mean the metaphorical, mm-hmm. But just move him off the third line.
You could play Sammy Fagamo. You could put in Brant Clark, right? You could do all those things, right? But it's just not one player. Like, it's the entire team. And he talked about it last night. The plays they were making in November, they're not making now. Like 4-on-2s, 3-on-2s, pass, like the pass on a 2-on-1, you know, pucks bouncing over sticks. There's a myriad of reasons why this team doesn't score. Yeah, sure, I'm all for it. And I'm not against putting those players in the lineup, but the thing that's going to be an immediate impact, John, like, you're guessing. Like, that's the whole thing. You're just guessing that these players are going to make an impact. And at this point in time, like, what's Todd going to do? He can't keep the same stuff going over and over again because the team offense is going. So you try to tinker with stuff. I'm not sure how effective it'll be. I believe it's about execution.
Like, of the players that they have, though, Dennis, because I don't think that Sammy or Clark coming in is going to completely change everything. That, to me, that's tweaking things at the margin. If you don't like Jad, or you don't like Grundstrom, or you don't like Lewis or whatever in the bottom six, and you want to rest a player and you want to put Sammy Fajimo in there, okay, fine, go ahead and do it. To me, that's not the issue. You need the big guys. You need the your top six, your top seven, your top eight forwards need to deliver. And Jordan Spence hasn't been the problem on defense. So putting Brant Clark into the lineup, I just don't see how that changes everything, especially because with a young player like Clark, he's going to be so hyper-focused on defense. He's not going to come in and give you a point per game pace at the NHL level like he is in the American Hockey League. He's not. Not yet. Not at this
age. And that's a great point. That's the key term, John. Not yet.
Not yet. Right.
He's not Cale Makar, but he might be close, and he comes in, but it's going to take time. Like, for the people think that's going to make a difference or move the needle, like, how long did it take Quentin Byfield to get going? How long did it take Vilardi to get going? Right? It didn't take overnight. So now you think these two players are going to come in and overnight they're going to lead the charge of a 7-game winning streak? Like, it's not reality. It takes time. Like, for people to say that Todd doesn't like Brant Clark, I mean, he said publicly the kid's going to be a star. I don't know.
Hold on. Yeah. I haven't heard that one. I know the normal rhetoric about he doesn't like. It's funny because, just a side note, I have half of social media it's asking me why he loves Jad so much and plays him so many minutes. And earlier this year, I had the other half asking why does he hate the kid so much and won't play him. So, but this is a new one. Brant Clark, he now hates Brant Clark?
Yeah, I had that on the road trip. When Clark got scratched, which they've said publicly, like some people,
Dennis, it was out there in our season preview. We laid out what the plan. People like to say, "Oh, you're patting yourself on the back." I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm trying to point out that if you read or listen, the information is available. Yeah. It's like the library is open. You have access to the book. Read it or listen. That the plan was for Brant Clark to go to the American Hockey League, for Jordan Spence to start the season, for Clark to get called up in January, and for them to split time.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
I don't understand. And here's the thing. Like Todd said, like they're trying to develop two young defensemen, and this connects back to your piece on Roy. Why are they taking a wait and see attitude? Because he's gonna get $5 million a year somewhere, and you've got Roy and you've got Spence and Clark. Those are your two guys behind Doughty next season. Like it makes sense when you take a breath and pause and try to figure out what the strategy is. And some fans just won't do that. Like that's why. Like trying to develop one young defenseman because they see what's coming in the offseason.
I'll entertain the question though, and then we need to get to a break. By the way, I haven't even mentioned yet. Former Dodgers general manager Ned Colletti is coming up today. I'm so excited for this conversation, and the timing could not be more interesting because. With Rob Blake being on some sort of a hot seat because of the performance of his team, whatever that means, now you get to hear from a general manager from the Los Angeles Dodgers who has now transitioned into hockey scouting of all things. What a bizarre story. I can't wait to talk more with Ned Colletti. I love the time I've spent with them over the last couple of years here and there. But anyway, the question is, I'll entertain the question, Dennis, which is, why don't you play Clark and Spence together?
Yeah.
My question is, how do you do that? Because it goes against everything that the team should have, and I'm using air quotes, quote unquote, learned last year. They learned the challenges of putting players out of position, right? And so how do you configure that? Do you put Clark and Spence together? Well, I don't like that idea because one of them is playing on their offside and they're two young kids. Okay, so do you put them on the second pairing right side and third pairing right side? Okay, then what do you do with Matt Roy? Now you're asking Matt Roy to move over and play the left side, which he hasn't done. Why do you want him to do that? Like, I don't understand how you would configure it. So it sounds great. It's a juicy headline, but to me, it's like clickbait. It's like, play them both. Okay, well, how do you do that?
You're a contending team, John. This is not, the Chicago Blackhawks where you can afford to do that. Like you're trying to win games and get to the playoffs, and that's two rookies, one out of position on the left side, who's I know one's never played there in the NHL, and the other one I maybe sparingly. Like that. Look, I get it. You're trying to move the paradigm. You're trying to shift things around, but there's certain moves that you can't afford to make, John. It's not about the moves you need to make; it's the ones you can't make, and I think that's one of them. It's just asking too much on a contending team that needs to find a way. Now you want to put two experienced guys once on his offside on the bottom pair? You could. Nothing stopping him. I just don't think that's the way to proceed.
All right, I can't believe we filled up the whole first period. We didn't even get into Rob Blake's comments. We didn't even get into the trade deadline, trade rumors, all sorts of good stuff. Let's do this, Dennis. Let's take a quick break, try to stay on schedule. We'll come back. We'll have Ned Colletti in the second period, and then in the third period, we can regroup on the Rob Blake press conference and talk more about the LA Kings and see if we can figure this out, Dennis, because this team cannot continue to lose or everybody's going to get fired. We'll be back right after the break. Welcome back. Second period. Really excited for our guest today. We're going to be joined by Ned Colletti, former general manager of the Dodgers, current scout with the San Jose Sharks. Yes, baseball to hockey. We have a lot to get to, so let's bring him on in. Ned, welcome to the program.
Hey, John. Good to be with you.
Well, look, it's good to connect with you, and I will. I told you this privately, but I'll let everybody know what an idiot I can be sometimes. You gave me your phone number a couple years ago, and I wanted to get you on the podcast. I lost your number. And I'm so thankful that we reconnected recently, and we're happy to have you on the program. Your story is a fascinating story to talk hockey and to talk baseball. I'm sure you don't remember this, but you and I first met back in 2013. It was a Penguins morning skate at Staples Center back then. And you were there to see your old friend, Tony Granato. We talked a little bit, did an interview. I talked to you later when I was covering Puig. You were out watching him at Rancho Cucamonga. And you told us some great stories about your friendship with Dean Lombardi. You were neighbors with Daryl Sutter. Not even really sure where to get started. But the timing of having you on today is so fascinating to me because of what the Kings are going through and having sat in the big chair with the Dodgers. I think it's interesting. But let's give everybody some background. So you grew up, correct me if I'm wrong, you grew up in the Cubs organization, you eventually went to the hated ones, you were with the Giants. What was that like leaving San Francisco, knowing the rivalry between those two clubs when you first signed on to be the GM of the Dodgers?
Well, thankfully, I wasn't from either city. I know the rivalry. I know it very, very well, and I knew it before I ever went to San Francisco, and then I saw it for 11 years working for the Giants, great respect for both organizations. And I think in some ways the Giants' success from the late 90s, about 1997 through about 04, 05, I know Dodgers had one division in there in 04, probably helped me get to LA because we played hard. Not we, they played hard. We had Brian Sabian and I had built strong teams that competed to the utmost. And that probably led to the Dodgers having some interest in bringing me down in November of 2005. And I was honored to do that job for 9 years. And I did TV for another 7 or 8 years. And I even won 4 Emmys with the group with this face, not easy to do. and in the meantime, halfway through my TV tenure, I started working in hockey. I've made a lot of friends in the game, and that's not what gets you hired. But we had many conversations late at night, whether it was Dean or Brian Burke or Doug Wilson, who hired me, or Ray Shero or Tony Granato, on and on. And when you coach or you general manage at that level, there's only so many people who understand what you're up against, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we all shared that, those challenges and those successes. And so we had a lot of commonality between me and a lot of the people that I met in the game that, you know, we could candidly discuss things and go through different scenarios, be it with ownership, be it with players, agents, whatever conversations you could have with other folks, but, they could give you advice, but they couldn't give you the same advice because they hadn't sat in the big chair yet, so to speak.
Yeah.
So that's really how my hockey career evolved. I think I've been with San Jose for six years now, I think. And I'm honored, absolutely honored to have a chance to work in the NHL as I was honored for 40 years to work in baseball.
What does Dean call you? And I ask you that because people in hockey love nicknames, the Y's and the IE. Even Dean is Dino, like some people prefer. Like, what does he call you? Are you just Ned? Or does he have a nickname for you?
You know what? I can't even tell you. I don't even know. That's a good question.
Are you prepared? Have you carved out a long week or two to read his book? You know, Dean's working on finishing a novel at this point. It might be three separate books. There's so much in there. But do you know about Lombardi's book?
I did not. That's awesome. Good for him.
Yeah.
I bet it's stunning. I mean, I spent a lot of time with him and Daryl and you know, sometime now with Todd, not as much because I'm working for the rival. But, you know, I've known Todd for a long time, going back to his San Jose days. Mm-hmm. But that's great for Dean. I can't wait to see it. And is it fiction? Is it fact based on, or is fiction based on fact? Or is it type of hockey?
With Dean, it's all of that. Yes. So Dean is working on a book that is going to, I think, explain the art of scouting and building a championship team. You know, it's funny because we're talking about the Sharks and being from Northern California. My belief has always been that Dean's interest in writing a book is because of Bill Walsh and the Dean's ties back to that. I think that Dean thinks, this is my opinion, I think Dean thinks that's going to be his final stamp on his legacy of writing a book and explaining things. But it's such, we had Dean on the podcast a few months back, and he basically said that his editors told him to rewrite the whole thing because, you know, it's too far out there. You know, you need like five PhDs to understand, you know, Dean, he's the mad scientist, you know?
Well, yeah, I had great times with him and Daryl. You know, sometimes he'd call me at 11 o'clock at night and say, "Hey, we're over in the garage having a beer in his actual garage. Why don't you come on over and help us figure some stuff out?" I mean, I grew very close to that group. Robbie was the assistant GM along with Ron Hextall. And I've known Nelson for a long time with those guys and Stoli and, you know, the whole group. So it was cool to be a part of it. And then, you know, I had designs on maybe going there at some point, but and then San Jose called, kept calling. So, they took me away.
One of the things that has stuck with me all these years from our first conversation back there in 2013 or one of those early conversations was you talking about the development of prospects. And you're basically, I'm paraphrasing some of our conversations, so correct me if I have it wrong, but that you were a big believer that it's important for young players to pay their dues in the minor leagues. And this is something that Dean was always talking about. You know, as a fan, people always want that young hotshot kid to come up and play, whether it's baseball or hockey, and play right away. But back then you were a big believer. No. You need to pay your dues in the minors and ride the buses and learn the systems and the routines. Do you still believe that today, or has the games changed and evolved to something different now?
Not for me. I think it's really important, and it's not to force people to be on a bus all night long or things like that. It's really the specialness and the uniqueness of the athletes at the top of their sport, be it NHL or Major League Baseball. It is not easy, and I candidly wanted to see a prospect actually fail in the minor leagues, fail and figure their way out of it. Because whether you're playing at crypto.com or the Shark Tank or Dodger Stadium or Oracle Field, that's a tough place to struggle for the first time and figure your way out. It's not easy to do it like that. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know that they could do that. And I wanted them to understand really the kind of the preciousness of where they get. And there was a handful of players that we developed, a lot of great players in LA, and you know, some that are probably going to be Hall of Famers or close to it. And you know, I would tell them, hey, you know, it's the ride is a long ride, and one thing, as talented as you are, that you don't know is you don't know yet what it's going to take. Mm-hmm. So let's take this time and let's figure out how you're going to not just become a big league player or a National Hockey League player, but how you're going to be able to be at the at your utmost, so that your skill level, your the way your mind works, the way your compete works, that you're not using half of it or 80% of it, that you figure out how to use all of it. I mean, I'm the guy that we drafted Kershaw, and actually I had to send him down after his first few starts because the command wasn't there, and he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, hey. You're at 100 pitches through four some innings, you're crushing the bullpen, throw strikes, they're not going to hit you hard. Mm-hmm. And I came back a few months later and did it. So it was even imperative for a first ballot Hall of Famer to spend a couple of years in the minors. I think 06 and 07, he was drafted in 06 and spent a year and a half. And then in 08, a little bit of both. But I think it's imperative that people understand what it is, because it's not once in a while. I've seen games in Rancho and, in the Cal League where a player would have a big league game where the at bats were great or the pitches were great or whatever, but it's not a once in a while thing. Mm-hmm. It's like once in a while, you're not the big league. If you're playing 7 days a week, five or six of them, your game is at another level mm-hmm. than the rest of your competition, not once or once in a while. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you got to get that consistency to it and understand how tough it is. I have so much respect for those who play at the highest levels. They are unique, very unique in how they think and how they play.
Without naming names, how difficult is it to have conversations sometimes with those young players, right? Because they have success. They were always the best player in high school or college or whatever, other leagues they were in. And they've always been put on a pedestal. And then in professional sports, when you reach the highest level, now when you're in those minor leagues, you do feel like, what are you talking about? What do you mean I belong there? You drafted me to be a major league player or an NHL player. And some of those kids, we'll call them, probably don't have the most positive reaction to that. How do you manage through those conversations?
Well, very, very few of them have a positive reaction to it. But it wasn't my responsibility to make sure they had a positive reaction. It was my responsibility and our player development people and our scouts and our leadership to have them be as good as they could be, mm-hmm. and to their benefit, no less. Mm-hmm. Kenley Jansen, we took him from being a catcher to making him a relief pitcher, late, like 5-6 years into his professional career. And for a week or so, he was not happy with me. And, he didn't want to do it. He said, I'm going to be a big league catcher. And, and now as time has gone on, we see that he's probably a Hall of Fame closer, it's something that we felt that we needed to do that just in the Kenley situation, but with anybody, to give them the best opportunity based on our experiences and where they're at and how they think. Because you scout everything, people think you just scout when the game starts. No, you're scouting almost every waking moment you're scouting. And I think that as time goes on, players realize it, but when you have those conversations, it's certainly not, the thing they're looking forward to.
The stats are, they're not easy, but the stats are easier to look at because they're readily available. Box scores and analytics now are more available, et cetera. But character-wise, Dean was always preaching about the need to dig deeper into players' backgrounds and how they were brought up. And you were talking earlier about the way their minds work and how they think. How do you measure those intangibles, the character part of it or the compete part, the things that... they are somewhat subjective.
Well, I don't think that anybody's ever had the perfect team. But I'll tell you something that John Scherholz, the great general manager from Kansas City, and, of course, the Atlanta Braves, told me when I was hired as a GM, and he and I have been associates for a long time by then. I said, give me a key if you don't mind. And he says, I always ask myself, can I trust the player? And it's not relegated to your stars. It's everybody. It's the player that is the top player in the minor leagues. It's the player who's the last player on the bench. It's everybody. And so I think when you think about trust, it's such a vital part of life in all walks of life that it goes to your character too. So You know, there were some players I signed that I knew right away, this is going to be a struggle. But again, you're talking about only a few that have the ability to play. So you're going to have some character in there that from time to time, you hope that the other people in the room can adjust to. But to answer your question, I mean, it's very important. I found those that don't have it, they will cost you at some point in time. Many times in a game, many times late in the season. It's just the way life works sometimes. And it's kind of maybe quirky on my part or whatever, but I wanted to see the players we drafted. I wanted to go see, especially our high picks. You know, luckily, we drafted late in the first round most of the time because the teams were really good. But I wanted to see how they treated their siblings. I wanted to see how they treated their parents, especially their mom. It told me a lot about who they are, believe it or not. And I think that when you see people in an environment that is outside of the field, rink, court, whatever the surface may be or the building may be, I think you can learn a lot about somebody. And that was very important to me all the way through. And again, I wasn't perfect at it because sometimes, you know, you're dealing with a people business. Some people are just going to look at life differently, and that's their call.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, something that I tried to always pay particular attention to, and I still do. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the grind a little bit, because I am fascinated. You weren't just a general manager. You were the general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, one of the most storied franchises in all of baseball. You're there for a long time. You're in the grind. You're in the thick of it now. You're at AHL arenas watching prospects. I mean, you're in it. Why at this stage in your career would you want to do something like that?
Wow, that's a great question. You're right. I mean, it is a grind. It's more lifestyle than job, I think, even though obviously you have tremendous responsibilities and, you know, it's more than just showing up. I was just talking to a Kings employee last night about this. I was walking in to see Nashville and LA play, and we were talking, and, you know, he's probably in the same generation as me. And he says, so how you doing? I mean, you've been doing all this stuff a long time. And I said, well, yeah, you know, he said, but I said, you know, when I walk in here, you know, I get fired up. I, you know, I'm driving down 110, you know, to go downtown. I get fired up. And, you know, anytime I walk into a rink, Ontario, anywhere, it's like I got a chance to see something tonight that's going to be different. That's going to be unique. I'm going to learn something. Mm-hmm. I learn something, John, every time I watch a game, or every time I talk to anybody in the game. Mm-hmm. I spend, you know, and you know, when I'm done, the thing I will probably miss most is the excitement of going into an arena or a stadium. Mm-hmm. The excitement of that and the conversations that take place. You know, you saw me in Ontario 10 days, 2 weeks ago, and you know, I spent 2 days with 2.5 days with the Barracuda staff. And, you know, I get there early to have conversations, spend as much time in conversation as possible, because I think that's how people learn, including me. Mm-hmm. I have never learned enough. And it's one of the things that does fuel me, is I have a chance to learn something every day, no matter what the topic is.
People should absolutely respect you. You had success in baseball, but we know how weird people can be also. Have you had to deal at all with people that have been like, you know, what does this guy know? He's a baseball guy. What's he doing over here in our world? You know, have you had to deal with that at all?
Well, if it's going on, they're not doing it to me. They've been great. I mean, I have a lot of friends now in the scouting community that, you know, we text and we compete obviously against each other type of thing. But no, I think they've been great. You know, I think at the beginning and maybe still a little bit now when people come in from the East Coast, because most of my work is Pacific Division stuff. You know, they go, oh yeah, yeah, the baseball guy. Yeah, yeah. Like I met Barry Trotz last night. Okay. You know, I've long respected Barry. I was a GM in Nashville.
Ned, who's taller? Goes, hold on. Who's taller? You or Barry?
Well, we kind of looked eye to eye, actually. You know, I think about it. And, he says, hey, I know the name. Hey, it's great to meet you. You know, I kind of know the story a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, for some people, I guess it was a curiosity. I think from time to time, it might still be a curiosity. It was probably a curiosity at the very beginning. But you know what I find interesting and so respectful on both sides? I've got a lot of questions for them, but they've also got a lot of questions for me.
Sure.
And typically, I mean, the last two or three World Series I've been in, going to have, 21, 22, 23, not 2020, because the Dodgers won it that year. But 21, 22, 23, I think I was in a rink the last game of the World Series. And so they'll put it on their computer between periods or before the start of the game and ask me to watch it with them and tell them what I'm seeing in the game. So it's been ultra respectful as I thought it would be, knowing how wonderful hockey people are, and they are. They've been great. I've made a lot of new friends that will be friends for as long as I'm around.
Yeah. Mark Yannetti, who's the Kings director of amateur scouting, fantastic guest, one of our most popular guests here on the program. He's very blunt. It's one of the things that I've always respected about him. And I love when he shares his pet peeves. And one of his pet peeves is scouts who leave a game early. What's your take on that?
Well, I tell you what, I learn a lot at the end of games. I learn a lot at the end of shifts. I've learned through the years that you can learn a lot about a player by how the team they are with views them. You can go to free agency. What players that are free agents that have been with another organization, does the organization want them back? Is it a matter of dollars and cents, or are they glad that the player is moving on? Mm-hmm. And so you pay attention to everybody that way. I also learn when I watch a game, like last night's game, 2-1 game. You find out who everybody trusts, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're the ones on the ice in the last 90 seconds or so.
Sure.
And so you can learn something all the time. You know, so it's all about the learning and piling up a little bit of information day after day after day. So, you've got to see something. I had a situation years ago. It was at the August 31st trading deadline with the Dodgers. It was a meaningless game on the schedule in which Pittsburgh was involved. And I had a scout in the ballpark. Scout could have left early. Okay. Scout didn't leave early. There was a player that we had interest in, an infielder. And in the ninth inning, and the last at bat, okay, ground ball, the infielder accidentally put his hand in the glove a second before the ball and could barely make the throw across the diamond. Game was over. Game was over. Game meant nothing in the standings. Scout calls me and he says, when you call the GM, because the deadline on August 31st is earlier than it is on July 31st or August 1st. The waiver deadline, the old waiver deadline, trading deadline. Mm-hmm. And he says, when you call, see how his right hand is, because I think he broke something. Hmm. Now, if that scout leaves,
right,
he ain't telling me that. Mm-hmm. So,
fascinating. We could talk for hours. You talk about those conversations. I would agree with you. One of my favorite things, going to the arena, would be the pregame meals, talking with different people, managers, scouts, coaches, whatever, that are there, and just those conversations. Could talk to you for hours. I'm going to leave you with this one, though. The timing of having you on is certainly interesting, because Rob Blake yesterday had his midseason meeting with the media. And among the topics, of course, was the potential firing of the coach, which is what fans and media look for when a team is struggling like this. Rob talked about not wanting to panic. And I'm just curious, can you draw back upon your time with the Dodgers when you're in the seat, and can you sort of relate to that? I don't know. I'm thinking maybe 2010, that was a difficult year, right? Maybe there's a different time where you something was keeping you up at night, where you were having to think, do I make a move? Oh no, cause that would be a panic move. Just, could you relate to that situation at all?
Well, the toughest thing to have, I can relate to it. Absolutely. The toughest thing to have in high-end sports, whether it's Division I college or pro, is patience. Nobody's more invested in the LA Kings than Rob Blake. Nobody looks at it more than Rob. Nobody looks at it more than Todd. Mm-hmm. So they are totally invested in it. I know them both very well. Very, very talented and very, very good people. And so, you know, when you struggle, yeah, certainly, you know, you're going to be asked these types of questions. I knew it was coming, but I would always just push it to the side because ownership and I are going to have final choice on it. I can take it back. I think it was 2013. Don Mattingly was our manager. And Hanley Ramirez had gotten hurt in the World Baseball Classic, had broken a finger. Okay, Yasiel Puig wasn't ready quite yet and hadn't been called up yet. And we were under 500. We may have been in last place. And I can remember being in Chattanooga, Tennessee, watching our double-A team and having my phone ring off the hook because people were speculating that we were going to fire Donnie. Hadn't even crossed my mind. Hadn't even crossed my mind because we needed to be patient. We needed to see our team play, get healthy, play to the full extent. And then, you know, then you can make a decision, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, so you got to be patient with it. But see, the thing that I whenever I see anything like this, I kind of, you know, I'm not saying I laugh or smirk, but I go, yeah, you know what? Everybody's calling for somebody to lose their gig for whatever reason. Okay. That's less than half of it to me. Because you better have somebody better that's going to sit in the seat, mm-hmm. that's going to be able to make things the way that, you know, you think they should be if you're going to make that first decision. And that's not easy to do. And it's just, you know, you've got to have the complete set. You've got to have your thought process. You've got to have a direction. You've got to have a decision. And if your decision is to change, you better have somebody that is going to be able to whatever the issues may be. And I'm not talking about the Kings. I'm just talking about in general.
Sure.
You better have somebody, you know, that's going to make whatever your team is struggling with, you know, your pitching, your defense, your base running, your fundamental play, your presentation, which I was always big on. You know, they're going to have to be better at it than the one sitting in the seat. Mm-hmm. Because that's just the way it needs to be. Now, fans, media, they don't have to worry about part two. Right?
Right.
They don't worry about part two. They just worry about part one. Well, part two is more important and as important as part one.
It's so funny. I've said this quite a few times recently that life normally, like outside of the bubble of pro sports, people don't like change. They just don't. That's why they very rarely move away from their hometown or, you know, more than 10 minutes away. Like, people don't like change. They don't like to change jobs. They don't like change of any kind. They don't like change. But for some reason in pro sports, back to your word of patience, everybody wants immediate gratification, immediate, you know, satisfaction. And so people clamor for change. They want a young player to come up from the minor leagues immediately. They want coaches fired. They want everything to happen immediately. And sometimes I think you have to really look big picture also. There's a third component to that, which is it's not just your team. There's 31 other teams in the league, and they're all trying to win too.
Yes. Yes, exactly right. I've said that many times. When people say, wow, that team, you know, kind of surprised you, beat you. I said, you know what? They're getting paid too. Yeah, you know, right. They're trying to win too. This isn't a one-sided deal where you're just playing against a machine or something, you know.
Yeah.
You're playing against other people, ultra competitive.
All right.
And that's, you know, that's the way it goes. That's what we do.
Well, Ned, we can be friends every other day of the year, but Monday, the Kings play the Sharks. You'll stay on your side of the press box. I'll stay on my side of the press box, and we can reconvene after that for a long conversation. How about that?
Well, don't lose my number this time, and don't be afraid to say hello if I see you up there on Monday night.
All right, Ned, thanks a lot. It was fantastic. Ned Colletti on Kings of the Podcast. We'll be back after the break. We'll talk more LA Kings hockey.
welcome back to the third period of Kings of the Podcast with DB and the Mayor.
All right, welcome back. Third period. Thanks to Ned Colletti for jumping in and sharing some hockey and baseball stories with us. We need to get him back on the podcast, talk for like a full 2 hours or something. But as exciting as it was to get him on this week, it was also bad timing, if you will, because we have so much to break down from the LA Kings offices in El Segundo. So, Dennis, just to regroup where we were in the first period, General Manager Rob Blake had a press conference on, I don't even know what day of the week it is anymore, Dennis. It's been such a trying week. That was on Thursday.
Thursday, correct.
In El Segundo at Toyota Sports Performance Center. And, okay, let's just try to go in order somewhat. So he came out at the very beginning of the press conference and he said, Blake Lizotte is going to be out week to week. Todd McClellan had kind of already spilled the beans on that and said that, hey, look, he's not going to return probably until after the All-Star break, which basically means February 10th, because the Kings don't play from February 1st to February 10th. Right. And so on February 10th, they come back against the Oilers. So that would be, at best, that's probably what you're looking at with Lizotte. The other context that Rob put there is when he said it's week to week, that doesn't mean he's coming back in a week. So they've kind of clarified as best they can. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an injury situation, so it's always a little bit fluid, but I think we have some clarity about what the situation is with Blake Lizotte. What's interesting to me about Blake Lizotte being out, multiple layers. Number one, at $1.6 million, although he's an RFA with arbitration rights, so he's not an unrestricted free agent, this is an interesting season for Blake Lizotte, because from a salary cap perspective, Dennis, there probably isn't room for Blake Lizotte to be on the team next year. They just simply can't afford to have a 4C making close to $2 million a year. So terrible timing, number one. And it's almost like you can do an audition with different centers. You could play Jad there. If Turcotte's healthy, you could call up Turcotte. You could call up Akil Thomas. You could let him play there. You could slide Trevor Lewis over. Not that he's a long-term solution, but I think they have a lot of options at 4C in this little window of time here. It goes back to something you said in the first period, though. You have to win games right now. So they don't have the luxury. This isn't training camp. It's not tryouts. You don't have the luxury of auditioning different guys. I'm simply pointing out that they have a lot of options that are available. They don't want to get rid of Blake Lizotte right now. Mm-hmm. Just like with Matt Roy, this roster, they want to take it. They want to carry it all the way into the playoffs. But before we move to Victor Arvidsson, any thoughts on Blake Lizotte being out, Dennis?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that about Caspi. I actually went to Cap Friendly and constructed a roster for next season for the Kings, right?
Okay.
And I have Blake Lizotte as a $2 million player. But what that probably means is you're probably going to need three players close to minimum on the team, which you might be able to happen. So it would be tough. The problem is he fits so well in that role, right? That's part of the issue. And I'll tell you this, and I wrote this in my column, it's a bigger loss than people think. It really is.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. So people undersell that, like they've undersold the, you know, Arvidsson being out all season, and now it's come to roost. So yeah, I agree with you. He's going to get a raise off that. And the question is, can you afford a $2 million 4C? Because that's what he is.
There's more than that, a 4C. But there's also more to that, though, Dennis, because, well, first off, I wish you were using Puckpedia, which is a partner of Mayor's Manor. But anyway, Victor Arvidsson and Matt Roy, I'm assuming that you don't have either of those players on the team then if you're trying to. Yeah. So see, that's what it is. You can't look at, not you, but these decisions can't be looked at in a vacuum.
No, absolutely not. Correct.
So I highly encourage people to go on mayorsmanor.com and read the article that I posted about 2 days ago that talked about why, or maybe it was, they're going to take this wait and see attitude, because at the bottom of that article, Dennis, I put in hypothetically a roster for next year, and I put right there how it all ties together from a cap perspective. I even tried to retain Arvidsson and retain Matt Roy and everything. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did that, Dennis, is this. It all comes back to Dubois. It always does. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, wow, they shouldn't have traded him and you know, they could have just re-signed him. No. The Kings were projected to be $5 million over the cap. If you go back to Mayor's Manor, at the end, there was an article in May at the end of the season when they were eliminated from the playoffs. We did the first look that we do every summer. Right. We said, here's how things look. And we projected Gabe Vilardi at $3.5 million on a bridge deal, all that stuff. The Kings were over the cap at that point, $5 million. So they didn't have a bunch of money to throw around to everybody. That's part of the reason why they had to get rid of Cal Peterson. And oh, by the way, they didn't get rid of $5 million in the Cal Peterson deal. They only got rid of $3 million because they took back on a $2 million dead cap hit. So again, this is where the context is very important. And instead of just overreacting emotionally to one player and one contract, people have to look at the bigger picture. Now, it's all there if you just want to read it and look at the numbers. This is also why you and I have said we don't think the Kings can afford Matt Roy. Now, if we wanted to have that type of show, Dennis, where like you take one side and I take the other side, I can give you an argument about how I think they can afford Matt Roy and and how I think that there is a likelihood, at least it should exist, that he would be willing to take a hometown discount. Because if this team is a Stanley Cup contender going forward, this is the team that he would want to be part of. This is the team that took a chance on him as a seventh round draft pick. This is a team who gave him the odds were so stacked against him ever making the NHL, Dennis.
100%.
Okay.
Great story.
I mean, 1%, right? Whatever it is.
And not only that, John, like, but playing 20 minutes a night, top four.
Yes.
Right. Not 12 minutes on the third pair.
Yes. And so if there was loyalty to, and I understand it's a business. So I get what the other side of the argument would be.
Oh, I'm
just giving you, if you wanted somebody to give you an argument to say, well, hold on, is there a chance? I would say, hell yeah, there's a chance. Because if you would have asked me, is there a chance that a seventh round draft pick makes it to the NHL playing 20 minutes a night? I would have said, there's a chance, but they're pretty slim. I would say the same thing here. There's a chance that Matt Roy returns. It's slim. Yep. But there's a chance. I could see a window. I could see his people and him coming to the team with the team friendly deal on a, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's a short term deal. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe he's perfectly happy. But I think about Jake Muzzin and I think about Alec Martinez. And that's what I wrote in the piece. Both guys took long term deals at $4 million back in the day. You've already seen the money for Mikey Anderson. If Matt Roy was willing to sign something similar, boy, that would really help and lock up Matt Roy. Potentially to return to the LA Kings. And then, but Dennis, it has domino impact back to Blake Mazzotte, right? If you sign him for four, can you really afford to sign Blake Mazzotte? No, you can't. And you also are saying that Victor Arvidsson is gone. And now you're asking Arthur Kaliev or somebody else. And Dennis, I don't think there is anybody else. I think
internally?
No. I think it's Arthur Kaliev. I don't think you can count on Turcotte or anybody else to step into that highly offensive role. You need Kalia.
Yeah, I think you. Well, the way I look at the run, you're going to have to sign like a middle six winger next year, right? For less money than you would sign Victor Arvidsson.
Yeah,
right.
You need Arvidsson.
If you do bring back, and if you do bring back Roy, then I assume Jordan Spence is your seventh defenseman, right? Because you assume
because Brent Clark would move into a starting role.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be interesting. But yeah, there's not a lot of movement. And Elliot Friedman keeps saying the Kings going looking at a goalie. I don't know. I don't know if Arvidsson's healthy. I don't know how you do it. Like, how do you? Where's the money? Where's the trade? Who do you trade off the roster to go get a goalie that's going to be a difference maker if that's what you want to do?
Dennis, some of this stuff that's out there is just craziness to me. There was an item yesterday about, if the Kings want Saros, they need to put Byfield in the deal. Quinton Byfield is not being traded for that goalie or any other goalie. He's not being traded. So that's a non-starter. Come up with something realistic. I don't know if that's great. Maybe Mayer's Manor and Fourth Period need to change their approach. If that's what we need to say to drive traffic to the website or the podcast, you know, I don't know, but I like to deal in reality. We got off track. So you said your piece about Lazat. Moving on to Victor Arvidsson. He then basically, again, confirmed an article that was on Mayer's Manor about, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, maybe at the end of December, talking about the timeline for Victor Arvidsson. He was expected to start skating in January, which he did. He is. Mm-hmm. He has been. He was now seen by the media. And then they're timelining that hopefully within the couple weeks leading into the trade deadline, so call it mid-February, late February, they're hoping to get him back if everything progresses. That would be fantastic for all the reasons we've talked about, Dennis. A right shot, he gives them energy, he gives them goals. Any thoughts on Victor Arvidsson coming back?
He's a 60-point player. Did people think the team was not going to miss him? Like, he was the what, second in power play points, I think second in power play goals last year. And not for nothing, the power play's been fine throughout this whole streak. I think they're like 27% conversion rate
on the road. Crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So, but this is a playmaker. And again, people don't want to hear this because we said it more than one time, but maybe that's the guy that unlocks Dubois. Maybe that's the guy that comes in, but we got to see if he's healthy and if he's the old Victor Arvidsson. And so, like, I really like this player. He's a playmaker. But when you have two back surgeries back to back, it's hard to look at a long-term deal for this player until he gets on the ice and shows he's the same guy that left from last season.
Yeah, for sure. Dean Lombardi has talked in the past about how it normally can take a player a full season to recover from some sort of a major surgery. I always think about Hanzus in that first year back and then how he progressed after that. So we might not even see the best version of Victor Arvidsson for quite some time. However, coming off the back surgery last time, Dennis, he didn't really seem to miss a beat. He stepped right in and was very productive. So let's see where that goes. We've covered the Todd part. So that was kind of a lot of questions about Todd back to Rob Blake's press conference. Maybe we can move beyond that. I think we're all in sort of a wait and see mode at this point. What happens here over the next couple of weeks? Okay. So he also talked about Dubois. He talked about Byfield. And with Dubois, he basically said he likes his 5-on-5 play, and he likes when the puck is on his stick. Those are some, I mean, I'm giving you the headlines, Dennis. Any comments about what Rob had to say about Dubois?
I like to see the puck go from his stick to the net, into the net. That's what I like to see more. It's disappointing, but, you know, he's the one that signed him. He's got to be, the accountability's there. I'm sure privately, They've had pointed conversations with this player.
Right? Each because of them.
The defense, yes, I'm sure, and more than one time, right? So it's just not good enough. And the people that said I told you so, well, right now they're right about this trade and this player, but again, the story hasn't been written. So there's not. And what do you expect them to say? Like, oh, I want to undo the trade. I'm calling up Chevy and say, can we renege on the trade? He's not going to do that. He's got to support his player, but the player has to be better.
Yeah. He also touched on, there wasn't really breaking news. He did touch on Brent Clark and Jordan Spence. And you know, he mentioned what we've talked about before. The reason that Brent Clark was called up at this time, is because they had the extra roster space to be able to do that, roster spot and cap space. Because Victor Arvidsson is still on LTIR. Once Victor Arvidsson returns, it basically resets everything to the same way that it was coming into the season, which is 21 players. They really don't have enough to even carry a 22nd player. Cop, and I did an article on this, and so people can look at the math if they're interested. Copley on LTIR helps them a little bit, but they still come up, I think, about 100,000, like 80,000 short of being able to add that other player. So they're still going to be around 21. You're going to see a lot of paper transactions. Sammy Fagamo, as an example, Dennis, has probably already been returned back to Ontario today on a paper transaction, keep him off the NHL roster for one day, and then they'll call him back up tomorrow for the New York game. So a lot of paper transactions coming, but anything that you want to say about Rob's comments regarding Clark or Spence?
No, because it's consistent with what was said at the start of the season.
Okay. He talked a little bit about Laffey and Kaliev. He did say they need more from Kaliev. And to me, Dennis, it comes back to Arvidsson, that if you have any thoughts of letting him walk at the end of the season, you better have a replacement. You either get it internally, and preferably you get it internally because internally is cheaper and you need all the inexpensive contracts you can gather because you have a lot of top-end contracts. Or you have to go outside the organization, as you said it, and sign a middle six type of winger. Any thoughts about what he said about Kaliev?
He's right. And look, you have Artie in the lineup to score goals. Mm-hmm. He scored 6 in 36 games. And he's been scratched, what, 2 or 3 games over the last stretch here? Again, not good enough. And it's not like he can add to this team, John, with respect to the other facets of his game. He's not a 200-foot player. He's not an intense forechecker, right? He's not a great defensive player. He's got to score goals. And if he's going to score at this pace, then, yeah, maybe he's a great bottom six, you know, forward that can score some goals. But you got to be better than 6 for 36, and you got to score a couple on the power play. It's just – it's it's a defining season for this player, I think, at this point, John. I think if you go and he gets to the finish line and he's got 10 goals, like, what do you do with him? Like, is that enough to say, okay, we can promote him to even the third line? I don't think so. I think the scratch, the first healthy scratch helped him. I think he came back more intense, a little bit harder on the puck, didn't make the bad decisions. Now he's kind of regressed back to a couple of plays last night weren't great decision-making. So, but again, this is a one-way player who's supposed to score goals. You need him to score goals. That's the bottom line.
All right, so here was the exact quote. When Blake was asked about the play of Arthur Kaliev this season, he said, "We need a little more from him. We have to get him to fit in a certain spot. He's a work in progress, and we have to continue to work with him." And then the follow-up question was, is that spot alongside Dubois? He said, with the top six that we've had the majority of the season, or that we've used the majority of the season, that's probably where, yeah. And so my question there becomes, what spot is he talking about? The spot on the power play, the spot in the lineup? And when the spot was asked alongside Dubois, well, with Arvidsson coming back, that gives you a third line of Kaliev, Arvidsson, and Dubois. That sounds a lot more appetizing than what they've had recently. It also begs the question of what happens to Laffey. We all sort of know from a cap management perspective that most likely means that Laffey would go to Ontario because they don't have room to carry a 13th forward. So the this all has dominoes, Dennis.
Yeah, it does.
Laffey doesn't require waivers. He can go down. However, if they don't have room for more than 12 forwards, that also means that Jad has to go back on waivers because he's been on the roster too long. And your other option, if you're like, no, I love Laffey. No, I love Jad. Like, you want to keep them? Well, the options are pretty limited because it's either Trevor Lewis going on waivers, and that's not happening, or Carl Grundstrom. And I don't want to over-dramatize this because we were talking earlier that the goaltending hasn't been good. But Dennis, Carl Grundstrom's numbers, his analytics have not been good.
No, he was not good at all.
Over the last 5 weeks, he had a strong start to the season. And I don't know what happened, but around the same time that Talbot, started going the wrong direction 30 days ago, mid-December, Carl Grundstrom's been going the wrong way either. But I don't know if I would like the idea of Carl Grundstrom going on waivers to keep Laffey or to keep Jad. It doesn't feel right, Dennis, because Grundstrom does still give you some physicality, which this team is light on.
Reaction? Yeah, I just think the player that's at jeopardy, at risk, would be Jad.
Yeah.
And that would be it, because which would be unfortunate, but he's a 13th forward and you can't carry 13 forwards.
Yeah.
Now, you could talk about the fall of Grundstrom's statistics and his analytics. Well, you could probably point at maybe 18 other players that through this stretch probably haven't performed as well each. But I will say one thing, can't put it on Drew Doughty. Like, he's played hard. I think he leads the league in time on ice for a defenseman. Like, he scored another power play goal. It's the first time he scored double digit goals in 5 seasons. But that's not why I gave him an A, John. You know why I gave him an A? For that response on Twitter. For the first time, I think, in years, he responded to the assertion that Matt Roy's been their best defenseman for the last 5 years. So.
Well, here's the thing, though, Dennis. You could really break that down. There were multiple things that he could have been responding to. Was he responding to that? Was he responding to the notion of trading Matt Roy? Like, what was he responding to? Only Drew knows. And even then, I'm not even sure if Drew knows. For all we know, Dennis, as funny as that response was, it very well could have just been like a butt dial. He might have done it by accident. Like, it's Drew Doughty. You know, I mean, who knows?
Trevor
Lewis might have taken his phone at lunch and Louis did it. It might not even have been Doughty.
Yeah, he might have been texting someone, ha, and instead he was on the app and it went through as a ha. But
very well could have been.
That moved him from an A minus to an A on my grade.
Fair enough.
He's been fantastic.
That's worth half a point.
Exactly.
Let's circle back real quickly on even strength. I think that we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
I don't remember what we talked about on air versus off air at this point, but the Kings have only scored 14 even strength goals, Dennis, in their last 11 games. So if you go back to when they lost to Vegas 3-2 and you look forward, they've only scored 14 even strength goals, 12 from the forward group and 2 from Matt Roy. And so they sort of break down like this: 3 from Kempe, 1 from Kopitar, and like one even strength goal from Kopitar in 11 games doesn't seem right, but it is. Byfield, 0. Trevor Moore, 3. He would be tied with Adrian Kempe. Deneau chipped in with a pair. Fiala has 1. Laffey actually has 1. And Dubois actually has 1. Kaliev doesn't have any. And the fourth line, as Todd said the other night, last night, fourth line hasn't been giving them anything. Lazat, Lewis, Grundstrom, Jad, if you book them together as the fourth line, zero goals, even strength from that group right there.
Yeah, but there's nothing to do. What are you going to do? Like you mentioned it yesterday, you asked Rob, how many levers can you pull? There aren't many levers to pull. And what makes it even harder is that you mentioned that lack of 5-on-5, and then you go back to my point where I said that in the last 11 games, they've lost 7-by-1 goal. So you like five goals over 11 games, 5-on-5, we're having an entirely different conversation. We're not talking about all the failures. We're not talking about changing the coach. We're not talking about that. So are they that far away? No, but again, you just got to win. It's winning time, John.
Yeah, it is. Back to the Dubois thing, though, because it at least would be interesting. One of the comments was that Dubois has been good 5-on-5. And Blake had pointed out when somebody had asked yesterday regarding like, well, hey, wait a minute, his numbers are down, you know, compared to previous. And again, context is important because he's not playing with the strength of players that he was before. But Blake's comment was, hey, look, at even strength, he's delivering at about what his career pace was. And the numbers sort of suggest that at an even strength that he's been on about what his career pace would be, DB.
Yeah. And I think it's the optics too. And I mentioned this and wrote about it. The way he plays the game, John, doesn't help that he's not performing to his price tag, right? There's a certain nonchalance about his game, and that's his style, and it's always been his style. But when you have guys like Trevor Moore and Blake Lazat out there busting their ass every night and looking like they're giving every ounce of energy, and he glides on the ice, that just adds to this bad mixture at this point in time, or the bad assessment of what he's doing. So, yeah, the numbers might be there, but, John, I just, like, take over a game.
Yeah,
like be the number one star of the game, and that also goes to the goaltending too. You look as good as they've been, like throw up a shutout, like go up a one goal game. It's hard when your team isn't playing well defensively, and they clearly are not. But I needed Dubois to like say, okay, we've lost 4-0. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to score 2 goals, get an assist, and when I win the game, I'm going to be number one star. He's never put himself in that position. So while the numbers might say, okay, yeah, he's along that path, take over a couple of games. He hasn't taken over a game. There hasn't been, except for maybe in Minnesota, I think he scored 2 goals. There really hasn't been a defining game for him. There's not been a seminal moment for him. And to me, that's the disappointing part of it.
Well, it was in like game 5 of the season, Dennis, when he scored a goal in his return to Winnipeg. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that's now, right. Exactly. That, so
there needs to be more of that in 2024. How about that?
100%.
Look, there's no reason to speculate if Kopitar is injured, but there were a lot of questions about Kopitar being potentially injured. Todd shut it down. You know, he gave sort of the standard coach line that everybody's banged up at this time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Blake was a little tongue-in-cheek saying he wasn't on the injury report for the day when asked about it. Kopitar's face-off numbers had slipped a little bit here over the last 30 days.
Yep.
Here's the interesting thing, though, DB. Todd was, I would say, a little defensive, maybe, or quick to retort at the very minimum when somebody asked about his usage of Andrei Kopitar.
Yep.
And he immediately pointed out that his minutes this year are down about 2 minutes, he said, compared to sort of his recent run rate. And yet last night, Kopitar played over 23 minutes. And then Todd talked about that in the post-game press conference and was saying, look, I'm going to have to talk to him about that. And we're going to have to see how much time he spends at practice today. Maybe he just rides the bike and then, you know, takes off. I just thought it was interesting because he was so emphatic about cutting his minutes down earlier in the day. And then 6 hours later or whatever it was, he's talking about playing him 23 minutes. I don't know. What do you make of that? I always find those type of things odd.
Well, it's a feel thing too. Like in the Dallas game, I think he played 15 minutes. Now the horse was out of the barn. They had a terrible third period. They weren't going to win that game. So he gave him 15 minutes, which is the right thing to do. He's a shade under 20 minutes. Like time on ice through 42 games, 1931. And he's been at 21, 20, you know, 20, 46, 2018. So they've lessened it. And that was the whole idea, right? But still,
hold on. Go to the game logs ahead. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it was lower. You're looking at the average and it was lower earlier in the year. And I think he's been playing more minutes recently outside of the Dallas game.
Yeah. Possibly. I'm looking at the big picture here, though. If you're talking about a 36-year-old player and do you need to use him less, they have used him less. Now, and here's the thing, though, John. Like, what did Todd say at the beginning of the season? Someone's going to get 19 minutes. Someone's going to get 17 minutes. Someone's going to get 13 minutes, right? Or whatever that adds up to 60, right? He's the 19 minute guy. So he's not dropping to 17 minutes, John. He's not going to 15. So he's going to be in and around this set. So if you think that 1 or 2 minutes a night is going to make a difference for a 36-year-old player, then you have a point. Like, does it look that way right now? Yeah. But look, everybody hits lulls in the season. He's a 36-year-old player. They've got a break coming up where he can, you know, regenerate and rest. He's not going to go to the All-Star game. But yeah, I mean, the numbers say, yes, there's been some usage, but you're right. It might be elevated. But again, when you're in the midst of a losing streak, do you want to pay your best player more? I think you do.
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to, I believe, is that, look, they needed something and they needed him. And Kopitar, when the room opened last night, almost as like an opening statement, he said, look, we have to be better and it starts with me. Now, I know some people say, you know, enough talk, more action and all that stuff, but at least he was saying the right thing. It does start with him. He's the captain. He's the leader of the team. Right. He's been their best player for more than a decade. He needs to produce.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, people don't talk about accountability. These players are accountable. They're not hiding. They talk to the media. They know they have to be better, right? And yeah, I talked to Kopi after the Florida game, and I asked him, what about the team confidence? He goes, look, is it 100% of where it needs to be right now? No, of course not, right? But they haven't quit on anything. Their special teams are still really good, so they're executing in some facets of the game. They got to be better 5-on-5. And, you know, if they don't, it's going to cost people their jobs.
Well, they need to be better on the power play at home also, Dennis, and they have three games coming up at home here. They have the New York Rangers, the San Jose Sharks, and Buffalo. Two of those three games should be winnable games. And, Dennis, if Dubois was able to summon the inner strength to deliver against his former team, the Winnipeg Jets, there are enough players on this team that need to summon their inner strength to be able to put up a win against the New York Rangers, a team they don't play often, but there's enough of a rivalry, even going back to their Stanley Cup run in 2014, as well as the fact that Jonathan Quick is going to be the goaltender. They can all hug him and high-five him and celebrate him before the game and after the game, but there's probably has not been a game in recent memory, Dennis, where they needed a win more than they need one on Saturday night, January 20th at Crypto.com Arena.
See, I think it's the two games behind it. I think that, like, look, they don't match up well against the Rangers. They don't play great against them. Like, who knows what the fan reaction is going to be with Quick back in the building, and I assume he's going to play. Like, I will say this. If you can't beat San Jose and Buffalo at home, then you got to make a significant change. I'll just leave it at that. So, yeah, because I'm not – when I look at that game on Saturday, I'm like, oh, I don't know. Like, the Rangers aren't playing great. They got blown out in Vegas the other night. And Vegas had like five guys out of the lineup. But to me, the critical, like you could play well, lose that game 3-2. The fans would say, okay, fire everybody. It's the next two games. Like the whole season right now, like could change rapidly if you can't beat San Jose and Buffalo. You got to win those games.
Those two games are more important. Yeah. I would agree. However, last night was a deflating moment. You could feel it. You could feel the energy. You could read the body language of people in and around the team. Like, oh, crap. We had a moment, right? Like, we could have, I'm speaking for them, they could have flushed the road trip, the terrible numbers, all the stuff.
Yeah.
The press conference could have been kind of a reset, right? Turn the flames down, turn the heat down. Just, they didn't even have to win convincingly. It could have been an ugly win, right? It could have been a weird deflection. Just get a win, not 1 point. Just get 2 points and turn the heat down a little bit. And they were in it right to the very end of the game. And when the final buzzer hit, you could just, I don't know, Dennis, you could look around and you could see it like, uh-oh, this is not good, right? And then that's why I'm saying the game on Saturday is important, though, because it'll just turn the heat down a little bit.
Oh, it'll definitely turn the heat down. But you're right. There were a lot of long faces. I rode the elevator in Florida after that one last second loss with some staff, and there was crickets and there were long faces. And last night when I'm standing outside the locker room, management comes by and the staff comes by, that no one is happy. It's just like, and it's almost like stunned, like bewilderment, like what's going on here? Like
I was stunned last night, Dennis. I said that comment to you. I said, I'm very rarely at a loss for words. I was at a loss for words last night. I did not have an answer. Like, I don't know.
That's saying something, John. Write that down.
What day was that? Money on them winning last night, Dennis.
January 18th, 2024. John was at a loss for words.
Okay, I was.
Write that one down. Okay.
What?
I get it.
You look at that team and you go, they should have won that game.
Yep.
So, all right. We're heading into Saturday. Jonathan Quick is back. I'm curious to see which Quickie shows up. Are we going to get park and ride, nothing from him, or are we going to get sentimental Jonathan Quick? It will be interesting to see which player opens up for comments to the media.
That will be part of what's a very well, they're all pivotal games at this point, John.
All right, DB. Let's regroup. We'll have another podcast for everybody soon. Hope you enjoyed today's program. We tried to take you through some therapy as well as had a fun chat with Ned Coletti. We'll be back soon with more Kings of the Podcast. Until then, we'll see you all on social media and I guess down by the media elevators. Until then, have a great weekend, everybody.
Cigarette, remembering what she said.